Ladies and gentlemen, it is my great honor and privilege to introduce Peter Anastas. I have the speech right here. I thought I had it memorized. What's the second line, Willie? He needs no introduction. If you live here, you know who he is already. He is the Gloucester writer, guided by love of Gloucester and the twin lights of Olson and Ferrini, and also Jack Kerouac and Charlie Parker. I saw Peter at the Gloucester High School Auditorium at a special assembly at the high school there when Peter was a high school boy and I was a Central Grammar kid, and we trooped up Granite Street to hear him. What was after that? Oh, yes. I was looking up to him then, and I'm still looking up to him. I should have my glasses on for this. Only now I have a shelf of his books. And I call him my friend. So, ladies and gentlemen, I give you Peter Anastas, whose job it is to write the secret history of Gloucester, Massachusetts.
Thank you, Willie. It's great to be here after how many storms and no parking, and I almost forgot how to write. I'm going to be reading from a novel that I'm working on. The title of the novel is Nostalgia. But in using the word nostalgia, I'm referring to its Greek root, nostos, which means homecoming, rather than employing it in the sense of a sentimental longing for the past. Inspired by Ed Sanders' investigative poetics, I'm attempting to write a forensic, what I call a forensic novel, using the techniques of fiction to conduct a post-mortem investigation into how the city of Gloucester came to be what it is today. Fiction. Much of the story is told through the eyes of a native who's come home. His name is Rob St. John, and he's returned home after many years of working as a journalist in Europe. The setting's local, and it's a few years into the future. The novel has an epigraph from the East German poet, Volker Braun. What I never had is being torn from me. What I did not live, I will miss forever. Sitting at a small round table in the big front window of Cafe Sicilia, Rob sipped his ristretto. As he looked across at the 19th century red brick buildings, they'd been restored since his last visit home, and the work was tasteful. What had changed were their contents. The main street he remembered, sawdust scattered across the floor at National Butcher's, the smell of freshly ground coffee as you pass Kennedy's Butter and Eggs, Harry's Delicatessen, the encompassing mirrors at Empire Clothing, where he saw himself in triplicate in his first long pants, Gillis's Barbershop, Sterling's Drugstore, Grant's, Gorin's, Woolworth's, Kresge's, Gray's Hardware, Sears and Roebuck, and the law offices, insurance agencies, and apartments on the floor above them. This main street had now been transformed into a row of boutiques and art galleries, topped by expensive condominiums. The Italian bakery directly across the street from the cafe was now a gourmet grocery. As he tried to picture the West End he'd known from childhood, Mike's pastry shop, Biscucci's shoe repair, a familiar figure came into view. He was slender and of medium height, lightly bearded, with a black beret on his head. He was carrying two cameras, one around his neck, the other on a strap, neither one digital. Sensing that he was being observed, he stopped to stare at Rob through the black circular lenses of his sunglasses. Then he knocked on the window. "You're back!" It was, it had to be, his old high school classmate, Sully Cameron. Rob waved him in, and the two men embraced. Cameron had about him the unmistakable smell of darkroom chemicals. "Sit, have some coffee." "I was just about to." Cameron signaled the counterman. Soon, a steaming cappuccino sat in front of him. "They know your preference." "I keep this place going." "The newcomers must like their lattes." "They get them at an upscale cafe down the street. The clientele here consists of natives like me and what's left of the fishermen. I notice there's some boats still in the harbor." "Don't blink." "I'll bet you're still taking those incredible pictures. Someone's got to document the demise of a once great port." Sully's face brightened. "If you got some time, I'll take you on a tour. I want to show you what's transpired since your last visit." Rob remembered his old friend Sully as a recluse. He had lived alone on Spring Street in a house left to him by his parents, an ancient Victorian with a mansard roof and a turret tall enough to be seen from the harbor. In Vietnam, Sully had been a sapper. His mission consisted of mining passageways dug by the Viet Cong. He worked at night, underground, armed with only a handgun, locating the tunnels that spread like rabbit warrens throughout South Vietnam, some of them 60 feet deep. Once he discovered a tunnel, he'd set the charges that would send explosions concatenating all through the system. Then he picked his way, often among smashed bodies, the groans of the dying, to find the sources of these tunnels, the command centers they hid. Deep into enemy territory, Sully crawled into Charlie's entrails, emerging days, weeks later, with fresh intelligence and eyes as wild as a jungle cat's. Sully had also learned photography in Vietnam. After his discharge, the Purple Heart, he got a job at the Gloucester Times. His pictures were so arresting that the paper began winning prizes. But some readers noticed a somber quality to many of them, as if each image contained a subtext about the hidden life of the city, slowly revealing its secrets. The Chamber of Commerce complained that Sully's front-page photographs made Gloucester look like the pinched, desolate Texas town in the last picture show. Portraits of fishermen and athletic stars seemed to reveal despair, increased faces and vacant eyes, rather than hope or bravery. But Sully went on his way, bearded, and with that black beret on his head given to him by one of the Viet Minh he'd befriended in country who'd gotten it off the corpse of a French colonial. He showed up at fires depicting a gas explosion as a raging inferno, the grief of homeless tenants, their belongings scattered along a sidewalk. Jimmy Cook, the editor who'd hired him, loved his work, and the reporters couldn't wait to see what Sully came in with next. But the publisher felt that Sully's stark images were bringing the paper down, and the city along with it. It was only when a startling sequence of grainy black and white prints Sully had snapped one night at a drug house on Portugee Hill had been discovered hanging to dry in the darkroom, ready for the next day's edition, that Sully was finally called on the carpet and let go. After they fired him, the Gloucester Times reverted to its stodginess. Even the reporters seemed to lose their former fire while Sully himself went underground. As the two men made their way across Main Street, heading down Rogers toward the town landing, Rob turned to Sully. "Are you still in the old house?" "I lost it," his friend answered glumly. "Couldn't work. Then my health gave out." "Where are you living?" "I'm still in the East End. I got a couple of rooms above the Brazilian grocery. Cold water, no heat."
"Jesus, at your age?"
"It's either that or elderly housing and no dark room. These are the choices you're given in America. I'm sleeping in my old bedroom." "Hey, at least you've got a roof over your head. Aren't you collecting social?" "That and disability. But the influx of money in town has driven all the rents up." Sully shook his head in disgust. "The whole city's ghettoized. The affluent have preempted the traditional neighborhoods. Those who rented are in public housing or living, like me, on the sufferance of slumlords." "Did any of this occur to the city councils when they were handing out all those development permits?"
"They couldn't give the city away fast enough.
I can't believe there wasn't a single person with vision in the administration or on the city council." Sully raised his eyebrows. "Anyone who demonstrated a smidgen of intelligence or imagination didn't last." "So the city sold itself down the river just like that?" "Not with a bang, but a whimper," Sully said dryly. "Come on, let's walk." They stood at the old town landing at St. Peter's parking lot. In front lay the inner harbor with a view out over the mansions of Rocky Neck, built in the 19th century by ship's captains and members of the codfish aristocracy. Families who owned the vessels and the companies that processed the fish they brought in from the Grand Banks, millions of pounds of cod and haddock. To their left, along Rogers Street, were restaurants, one after the other, flanked by tour buses that had begun to disgorge passengers who lined up like school children waiting for lunch. "They call this street Restaurant Row," now Sully said. "Just imagine, when we were kids, there were ship's chandlers and machine shops here. You could peek in and see guys soldering sheet metal or repairing ship's radios. All that's gone. Now it's just places for tourists to chow down on the run. At night, the black cards come out. The view is what they come for, mostly. But there's little to see but yachts."
"Where's the Bird's Eye Tower?"
Rob asked as they crossed the parking lot to enter Commercial Street. "That came down when they built the hotel."
"Don't tell me there's a hotel where we brought our dates for Greasy Pole?"
"That's not the half of it." Sully pointed to the left of the street, which had once been crowded with fish processing plants.
"What happened to Frontera Brothers?"
"Bought and leveled. Pretty soon condos going up."
"I thought they were port restrictions."
"They shot those regs down. You can build practically anything you want on the water now."
"My God, Sully, the waterfront was the last stand for the fishing industry."
"The boats are confined to the state pier. What few remain." As they passed the massive gated hotel, which cut off any water view as it loomed over Pavilion Beach, where he and Tony would cuddle with their girlfriends during fireworks for St. Peter's, Rob noticed that most of the duplexes and single-family houses at the entrance to Fort Square had been demolished. The tiny park on the corner remained, the crooked street now darkened by the overhang of luxury condominiums and an enclave of trophy houses that lined the water side of the square.
"Where's the house that Olson lived in?"
"They tore it down for condos. Someone bought the whole street. Next thing you know, they leveled it."
"What became of all the Sicilian families who lived here?"
"They saw the handwriting on the wall and split. With property values escalating along with taxes, they had little choice."
"Sounds like they were forced out."
"Pretty much so," Sully said, pointing his handheld camera down the street.
"There used to be some wonderful shadows," he said. "And gardens," Rob replied. "I remember the old Italian men growing their own grapes."
"Those arbors are all plowed under. There's nothing left of the kitchen gardens either. A whole way of life was wiped out. The hotel went up and it was curtains for the rest of the neighborhood." Rob stopped in the middle of the street as they rounded Fort Square. I wish I'd been here with you." He looked at Sully, who stood with camera in hand, a bleak look on his usual affectless face.
I was investigating reports of genocide in Bosnia. while my own hometown was under siege. You have no idea how vicious it was, Sully said. Talk about ethnic cleansing. They forced just about all of us out of the houses we were born in. Once they got the rezoning they needed, it was a feeding frenzy. Naturally, they replicated the zoning in every neighborhood they had their sights on, especially the hill with its views over the harbor. No matter what the state of the economy, there's always money for development, especially if it meets the needs of the one percenters. And they've really come to Gloucester? Sully scoffed. They maxed out on the Cape. Marblehead had already gone. Newburyport was next. Gloucester was the last outpost. We held out as long as we could. Then the old-timers died. Those who had a sense that you didn't shit in your own backyard, much less sell it to the highest bidder. Once they were gone and their kids had fled to Beverly, where the housing prices were still reasonable, it was sayonara for the rest of us. Sully, I'm devastated. Rob turned again toward his friend. I heard that Gloucester was going the way of Nantucket, but I never thought it would be this complete. I suppose I was in denial. Hey, I'm still in denial. Stop by the house. I've got a slideshow I want you to see. Rob made his way home from Sully's in a daze. In the darkened front room of his friend's cramped apartment, he'd seen the city he grew up in, the city he had known as intimately as his own body, pass by his eyes in the form of stark black and white images Sully had recorded before the hotel had been built on the fort and the waterfront had fallen to development that had nothing to do with fishing. Sully had walked each neighborhood during every hour of the day and far into the night, summer, and winter. He had taken pictures of the houses, those with clapboards dating back to the 18th and 19th centuries, and those covered by asphalt shingles or aluminum siding from more recent decades. He had haunted the remaining fish processing plants and recorded the people at work cutting and packing fish, shoveling the entrails into containers to be shipped to factories that turned them into mink food and plant fertilizer. He documented both the making of ice for the fishing vessels and the unloading of the catches jeweled by its still frozen shards. The slides showed portrait after portrait of laborers, men and women, work-tired in old clothes and rubber boots, standing on slippery concrete floors as the fish rushed past them on conveyor belts. As he looked at the slides, digitized into a video that Sully projected onto a screen, his entire life in Gloucester, the life he'd run from, the family he'd abandoned to travel the world in search of stories, passed in front of his eyes. That's just one show, Sully said, as the soundtrack of Miles Davis's somber music of irretrievable loss wound down. Call it an overview. I've got the demise of the fort. I dogged the destroyers as they tore it down, brick by brick. Sully, Rob said, I've seen a lot of pictures, but I've never been so moved. Maybe because it's part of your life, Sully said, as he reached over to shut down his laptop. Okay, thank you. It's difficult. This is the first time I have ever read work, unpublished work, it's been difficult for me because when the work's in process, it's not a completed product. So I deeply appreciate your indulgence. I'm going to introduce Casey. we'll have some time for questions and talk after Casey and I finish. Casey Buckles is a Gloucester native. He graduated from Gloucester High School and studied philosophy, literature, and anthropology at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. I met Casey through our mutual friend Ernie Morin, whose photographs of Gloucester have had an impact on both of our work. I've been reading Casey's poetry and fiction for several years. I'm as intrigued by his vision as I am by the way he writes about Gloucester, describing, and I'm quoting from his own words, what's here buried beneath daylight's weight and liberated in the solitude of night. I'm introducing Casey Buckles.
This is fun. This is my first real event after I did the book release in September. So bear with me, because this is pretty hard. You know, I don't really plan a lot. So I was thankful when it snowed a lot in February, because I figured I'd have time to plan for more. But like my dad, who arrived late, proves that I, too, did not plan for tonight as well as I should have. So I don't know where to start, and I think that's best how to describe what I have here, is I never knew where to start, and I'm really focused on details. So just thinking all the time at the library, at home, walking alone when I lived abroad or not, just constantly thinking about a simple story that took too long to make and can be kind of too complicated to read. I think the best thing I could do to help those who have read it and those who hopefully will read it after tonight is kind of break into the puzzle that I've made for myself while writing this and kind of the labyrinth that other people have to work their way through and out to try to get some understanding out of the book, let alone what it's trying to say. I'm trying to think. So this comes at part two. And what made it more difficult is that I don't have page numbers, and there's three sections that aren't separated. The three sections are called Artificial Horizon, and the first line from that section is Think What Could Be. The second section is called Ebb Tide, and that sentence starts with whatever, what should we do? And then the last section is Flood Tide, which starts with the word color. I was going to say on the title page, I have Plain of Ghosts, which is the title of the book, To Nobody, and You Know Who You Are. And then underneath that is the disclaimer, all persons and events are from stock. Their resemblance to the real world is purely fictitious. So let me jump ahead pretty late in the first part. Lost my place. Right, here we go. So the story, although it starts, the very first kind of page starts with now. It's not now as in today, but probably when I started it. 2007. So that's kind of at the time when the hotel was kind of first being brought to like big attention and kind of all that stuff. So this is what I'll read from. It's kind of the kernel of meaning for the story as a whole. He could have tried harder, crawled over low tide, grope slick, coarse rocks, pulled at slimy seaweeds, uncovering her cold, white body, that one we crave definition from, so to deep six between her legs. Without passion, she'd followed, forced from what's expected of her, demands of the sentimental crowd, perverted with theatrics, offering no meaning, existing for more. Steamy scenes of our mental masturbation, releasing in us knowledge of not being alone when needing, more than what we've all agreed to offer each other. Satisfaction planned. Excused bad choices, stowed with other pleasureless moments, boxed neatly besides other plastic siding homes aglow. Oblivious, still holding out, with faith in the good to come, the promise of being led and a future to redeem us now. So I think, follow only the pogrom. In opposition, we find ways to justify by attempting to live simply and demanding dignity with protest withheld by our lips and mouths. Life, hazy rapture, where consequence no longer enters consciousness. Anything other than being dissatisfied when having no conception of what to say when speaking. Sensing loss, but caring less for what it is, accepting only mundane reasoning. With few opportunities, we watch, craving a happy ending, not knowing what happiness means. And the story could have stopped there. As Noah turns to leave, he sees at the end her. And then I'll leave it off. So you have something to look forward to. I will say that there's really only there's one main character, Noah, who is kind of not there in the story, and who through the reader gets a lot of the detail. And I like detail, and I kind of go over and over trying to find detail. And so this story doesn't really flow as easy as Peter's had, because Peter's is pretty... He knew where the characters were coming from, where they were going, what jobs they had. He had a whole backstory. And for me, I didn't really have much of that planned. So Noah, Jubilee, I think there's someone called Nate, are kind of the only characters, and you don't know where they really came from, where they're really going. But through small details in the text comes out a whole story. And I think that's where the difficulty lies in reading it, even for me, since I haven't read it in a long time, because I got tired of working on it for so long, is finding the places where I cut lines so I could separate kind of as a pivot word, kind of make three meanings happen in two sentences. We're splitting sentences at the end so that words carried more weight. It's pretty dark, mostly happens at night, but there's a lot of humor that I find funny. There's a section towards the beginning that's kind of a typical walking downtown, meeting up with friends you haven't seen in a while and kind of talking about the past. Never amused by Nate's hackneyed gestures, nor mulls his lips over his teeth. What's that supposed to mean? People in the group raise their eyebrows and drop their mouths and slowly shake their head. Nate peers and slowly places a hand on Noah's shoulder to gently push and pull in the manner of disbelief. Didn't you hear the sob story? Noah relaxes his tight eyes and says softly, nah. Where in the hell have you been? It's been all over the GDT. Anyways. Scola died. Noah backs away on instincts from the weight of the statement. Oh, ain't it too bad, but don't look so shocked. Which Scola? Guess. The one off Centennial? Nah. The one on the hill? I think. That's Petey Wright. Graduated a year after us. No, Sam. The one on Grand Street, then? Oh, Peter. He moved to Washington. Did he marry Frontiero? Who hasn't? You're right. Oh, Pete Scola. Off lookout, then. But he married a Palazzola. Yeah. Poor sods in the ground. A few ladies put dry kerchiefs to their powdered cheeks and remained steadfast despite small quivers. I was sure you knew. Sorry, man. Nate takes in Noah with a strained hug, his body heaving as he stifles a bubbling giddiness. During the long pause, Noah winks over warming eyes and abruptly lets go. His heart does not feel the need to mourn. With respect, he shrugs at what seemed the inevitable, proven by the exemplary modes of Gloucester past. Well, in a pretty serious scene of just saying how our friends died can kind of turn comical. Because how many Scolas are there in town? If you walk through now, walk through. Okay, towards the end of the book, it goes from following Noah on the outside to going in to his personal thought. And to achieve that, I used colored backgrounds from watercolors that my mom had made. I don't know when, but I found them. And so I try to pick the appropriate colors to fill in for what's happening in the background. And with a lot of people who have read it, they've always found this section the easiest to read through. Except for when I put the colored background in it, then the letters became hard to read. But I justify that by saying the colors should also carry the meaning. But I don't know if that holds true for everybody. She didn't want to ask why I was unhappy, too. I'd asked because I wanted it to be over without owning it. So waiting, she just wanted to go along, wasting life, ashamed of what she looked like, self-pitying and arrogant when seeing me sad, ignoring and suddenly happy, forced pretending she didn't notice, too selfish to answer, scared to understand herself. Days spent waiting to choose, rushing for the next fun thing, and hours to pass, sun sinks, we're back having done nothing, except half-heartedly shop for things to fill in our cold apartment. Then a couch, a movie, an electronic blue flickering, my head on her lap, her hand lifeless on my hair. Bed, one or two hands, ejaculation lost in the sheets, in and out of my tongue in the pubic hair. A finger up her butt, she's done. Sleep, awaking, less talking, less holding. Unresponsive, good morning, when shall we meet? I love you, goodbye. Take with you our memories, leave. Maybe then your absence may finally bring pleasure. Wait, how can you walk away so easy? Waiting is no longer an antagonist. I've held on to the same story without significance. Seeking completement in someone else, I convince myself to follow an original idea, going over and over these streets and ideas. Revising revised deemed truths I never felt, insisting upon meaning in a climax, a resolution, and ending cool with a jarring conclusion, sterile from incubation. I could have continued, grafting a short story over life's work, choosing an end and claiming retroactively that the universe led to this perfected moment, my life's meaning. Through her, I'd achieve, with complacency, projecting struggle and success without it lived. I know she didn't fulfill. In the right dramatic moment, my voice could have swooped in with redeeming dialogue to save me from answering the living questions. Meanwhile, in silence, I tried to survive, hoping the surroundings could speak for me, aching to hear my heart resound in someone else. I settled for sex. I only worked at lowering expectations. I suffered not in the sweet ecstasy of entering the timeless realm with her, but forcing alternatives. I insisted on suppression until at last desire erupted to the surface to mock. Still, I denied. Once I desired to explode into flowers, to scatter with wind, to be carried along in a warmed embrace, exfoliating rapture and rooted in water, and once knowing what that actually meant. I will choose to be alone, to explore for myself and enjoy what I wanted to and where I wanted to go, a future of what I please change. I think I'll finish off with a page after what Peter had spoiled by reading the first page of the book with the, which is either the second or third page, and that is, think what could be waiting just there at the end. Thank you. Oh, and I wanted to thank everybody who came. A lot of you I see around downtown, and I've never been here either, so it's nice that everyone showed up.
So would you mind reading the thing that Peter read?
You want me to?
Yeah, read it. Read it. They should hear it in your voice.
Well, I don't have a good reading voice.
You
pass through this translucent ink. Leave behind the familiar shapes and sounds of surrounding form, for a fishy smell rouses what lies beyond the inner harbor. Upon emerging, listen to what's here, buried beneath daylight's weight and liberated in the solitude of night.
One of the things that I have just liked so much about Casey's work over the years and that... the poetry and the prose works together for Casey. Casey can tell a story, and he really can tell a wonderful story. When you read his book, you'll see one of the things that's so powerful for me is getting a sense of people in Casey's generation in Gloucester, how they're living in Gloucester, how are they feeling, how are they thinking, what does Gloucester mean to them, what do their lives mean to them here, and I think there's a thing that Casey does. There's a sense of despair sometimes that emerges in Casey's work that is just so powerful, and it's one of the reasons that I've liked it so much. And not just because of despair, but he's gotten under the surface of a Gloucester life, and shown us in a sense how a whole part of a generation here is living, which has never been seen before. It's one of the things that I like so much about about your work.
Why don't you ask us some questions, if you'd like? We can just talk back and forth. Something about what I read or what Casey read or what we're doing. Yes.
Casey, do you write every day?
No, because it's too... It's boring. and it's kind of too hard to do it every day because it's actually hard on the mind, I found, to do it every day because typically it takes 2 hours. And it's kind of like exercising where you have, I mean, this is in my instance, have about 30 minutes of warm-up where you kind of doubt everything and while you're sitting there and if you will actually go through with it. And then after, if you break through that, then there's probably a good half hour, 45 minutes of writing. And then there's like the cool down period where you know you should stop, but you kind of keep pushing it until you stop. So I haven't really written in probably a year and only recently have been trying to. And it came back easy at first, and then second and third day it wasn't. So I think it'll always be that way.
What do you do for work? What's your work?
Right now, I work at Parley Cycles as quality control, being the real specialty. And I want to thank the bosses for coming out tonight. But it's kind of work that fits how I think, because I have to find very small, detailed things in bike frames.
He's doing a great job.
Now, unfortunately, I can't say that I found all the mistakes in my book until after I printed a lot of copies. So, oh well. Next time.
It goes with the territory.
Yeah. I had a few, and they helped, and they didn't help. And the ones who helped probably helped in ways they thought they didn't think they were helping in. Peter was an early reader, and he was always helpful. And he and Ernie were probably the longest running and the earliest. Probably 2007, wow. I think.
Yeah.
And so he saw that book go from hundreds of pages to many...
Hundreds.
To the hundreds. Short, back to many pages and back. So it kept fluxing between the two extremes until I settled. And kind of last year when I didn't have a job was when I kind of decided to take the time to finish it because I knew the general shape and idea that I wanted to do. And even after having worked on it for 5+ years, it wasn't until the very end where I had all the material ready, and none of it was original practically from the beginning, except for a few lines. So I know Joanne helped read very early on. I think she was the first non-Ernie or Peter. That's great. So she was the first new eyes to it, and that just doing that helped because it's not easy.
I just read a novel that a friend of mine wrote as a beta reader, and so it was an interesting process to read someone's first piece and then be told, you know, now is not the time to be kind to my feelings. You know, please say what you see, what you hear, what you think, and what you feel. And that was a helpful guide for me. You know, I consulted what she asked from me several times when I was writing the criticism. So, you know, I think it's a really trusting relationship that, you know, you're putting yourself right out there in their hand to say, you know, it's like taking your heart out of your chest and handing it to someone.
And I wish people would have been more negative from the beginning, but it I don't know if it would help because I can be kind of arrogant when it comes to what my idea is. So even when there were some negative things, I was like, whatever.
Yeah, Casey, I'm a frontiero, you know. I was interviewed in Peter's book when Gloucester was Gloucester.
That's right.
Excellent.
That you were
back in the 70s.
You were one of the first people that that Peter and I interviewed.
Peter
and I, yeah. Well, you know, the thing is, I think criticism is important and necessary. As a teacher, what I found was that I wanted to encourage my students to write. The worst thing you can do is slap someone down when they're just beginning. And at that wonderful moment where the language is coming together, when Ernie first gave me some work of Casey's to read, I wasn't really wanting to think about the form, the structure, the this, the that. I wanted to enter the language. Language, I'm always interested in language. I'm always interested in how people use language, what they do with language, how they express themselves. And what drew me to Casey's work is that Casey has an extraordinary sense of language. And I didn't feel that that should be violated. I thought at another time we could talk about structure, and I wanted to encourage because as you can see from reading tonight, Casey does some wonderful things with language, but there's always story, you know, in what you do. You're never far away from story, honestly, it's one of the reasons that your work is so interesting, and I just wish and hope more of it can get out and more people can read it, because you're doing things, you know, that I think are important. I mean, you're coming at Gloucester in a way that's very different from the way I come at Gloucester. Mm-hmm. Or a number of the poets who write about Gloucester or other fiction writers come at Gloucester. I think you're coming at Gloucester not only from your own experience, but from a very original sense of how you see things. And so that's one of the reasons that I always try to encourage you.
There's a lot of humor. I appreciate the humor. I love the one with the Skolas. I don't know. It's making me really laugh. But the dialogue that was going back. That was just very funny and very Gloucester. I think you really had something. And with dialogue, I love that about Peters and many other things as well, but I love the way that dialogue, I thought it was very real between the journalists going back and his friend and the clipped way and just kind of slowly finding out, getting into the story, a lot through dialogue.
This is the first time I've depended more heavily on dialogue than I ever have before to tell a story. And I don't know where I'm going with it and what's going to happen, but and thank you for saying that. But when you're writing about these kinds of things, I wanted to step away from literature. I wanted to step away from the literary. I'm not writing an art novel. I'm much more influenced by the proletarian writing of the 30s, the political writing of the 30s. And I don't want to be afraid of putting in the book what people say. I mean, I've done plenty of writing in which I've come at the story in a very literary way. And I'm at the stage in my own life where, you know, it's sort of literature's passed through me in some ways. I mean, I'm always reading, I'm always thinking, but I'm trying to figure out how do people talk? how do people talk? And when you're involved in political activity, like I've been all these years in Gloucester, what happens when people talk? What happens in meetings? What happens when people are talking about what they're reading in the newspaper? What happens when you're confronted with powerful change in front of your face? How can fiction deal with that? You can't deal with that by writing it in another dimension, you know? And so what I thought was, I thought what I would do is come at this book in some way as a looking at a worst case scenario, you know. And I mean, I may write it, as I revise. And remember, I mean, you're listening practically to draft tonight. As I revise, I may revise it down and shape it in some ways. It's rawer. What you were giving tonight is rawer than usual, but I wanted to push the envelope. I wanted to push it before, but you know, sometimes, you know, I usually start a book in a much more timid way, in a sense that, well, you know, I mean, this is the shape, you know, and this is going to fit into the shape, and these are the characters. In this particular case, I said, no, I'm just going to let it all hang out. I'm going to let it hang out and write this thing hung out until I get to the end of it. And it's good, like with Casey, there's going to be a very long book, but it won't emerge. I mean, that's not the form that it'll be published in.
Right.
I mean, that's one thing I've learned from you. I mean, and I don't mean you overwrite.
Yeah.
I don't mean you overwrite, Casey, but but it's been very helpful to me to see your process. Because I tend to be more uptight in my process, you know. So it's been good to me to see your process and to experience it. So anyway, I don't mean to go on, but I mean that's what I'm. But the dialogue, particularly, what were you going to say, Susan?
No, I was impressed with dialogue in both of your work and very different voices. But and for me, Peter, reading your work, it is really different. But I think. In just as in Casey's with the Scola one, you really are using dialogue well to tell a story, and I'm sure you'll revise. One always does, but just the clipped way that the photographer is kind of telling him this really awful situation. I mean, I think it works.
Well, thank you. What's going to happen? And I don't. This isn't going to be too much of a spoiler alert. The protagonist, who's worked his whole life as a journalist, comes home and can't stop working as a journalist and wants to get to the heart, the core of what's happened in Gloucester. And that's going to be, that's the story of the book. So I'm not giving it away. I mean, that's, but that's what's going to happen. He wants to get to the core. This is just the beginning. This is, we're on the outside now. But we're going to get to the inside, and we're going to get deeper and deeper and deeper, and it's going to be more forensic, and we're going to be looking at court records, and I'm going to bring a lot of texts to bear on this book by the time I get through with it. And I don't plan to finish it right away. It's not a book that it's the last book that I'm ever going to write, and I'm not going to hurry it. So just to be honest with you, Skylar.
Peter, I'm curious about where you imagine this piece in the whole thing, but it struck me, as since it was the first thing I heard, as an overture, in a way. And, you know, when you're talking about describing, how do you describe what's happening? It was, you know, that is indeed difficult, if not impossible, to do, because we're usually writing after the fact, but your attempt to do that, the image that comes to my mind is these two characters are sort of wandering around the ruins of Rome, or the ruins of the devastation, which is something I've been writing a fair bit about, the aftermath, the aftermath of the cataclysm, the fall of civilizations, essentially, and it was just very interesting the way the narrator, the protagonist, was remembering places on Main Street, which are no longer there, haven't been there for a long time, which I don't even know about. So that was very vivid, and then there's the past coming into the present there, right? The past becomes vivid, and then the slideshow, which is described in advance by the descriptions of the photos, you realize, well, now they're looking at it again. It's like it really is a forensic examination, mm-hmm. because how many different ways mm-hmm. can you look at what's going on and what's going on? You know, I mean, I thought that was very, very interesting.
Well, thanks. The point is, I had two choices. I could write a nonfiction book and try to write about what we've all lived through these past 25 or 30 or 40 years. I wasn't moved to do that. I wanted to do what you've described. And the driving force is I've been spending a lot of time thinking about the concept of melancholia. I've gone back and I've read some of the original, the Ur text, the Freud. But what I'm looking at is there's a process that's going on in the post-communist world in which writers and artists are looking back on the ruins of socialism. And they're looking back at it in this kind of reverse melancholia. This line from this extraordinary East German poet that I quote. I've been reading a lot of writing coming out of the post-communist world. What I never had is being torn from me. What I did not live, I will miss forever. And that is at the core of a kind of melancholia, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
If you look at it from the psychoanalytical point of view. And you could think of it, too, also from the political point of view. And these are the kinds of things that I'm struggling with as I put this book together. I want to create a deep structure for this book. And I want that deep structure to be around these themes. Not just to simply tell a story. I apologize for talking too much. But thank you for asking me.
Casey, I find a lot of your writing very almost like poetry. Have you thought about writing poems or?
Some of them came out doing it that way. Poetry, I would think, as kind of having more of a structure to it that I like thought about beforehand and then kind of filled in the lines afterwards. But eventually, because you know me, I get bored kind of easy. I just kept having to try to do what felt interesting. So now that I'm working on something new, I don't think of how the form will be. I just write it, and then whatever it comes out to be, I'll look at it, go back to it months later, try to find what's good about it, and then from there, see how it fits. And that's why a lot of the pages are so different in that they're not just straight text pages, some from the line splits or the line spaces, dialogue. I just wanted to make something that was interesting to read, inform. So, however that works.
Okay, so Casey, what do you call that then? If you are doing line breaks?
Yeah.
Okay, but you're telling a narrative at the same time? I know you're resisting labels, but how would you say what that is? Is that like saga, you know, poetry? Is it prose poetry? Do you have something in your head that you're thinking that this is what this is?
I just always call it a story. Uh-huh. And because I always get that question, and I get it, got it at work a lot today. Well, what's it about? And that's not an easy question, especially for this, because I can't go, well, it's about Noah, and then Noah does this. And I want to tell more than I want to, because I want the reader to find out for themselves.
Yeah, so that's the story, but you also do have this form. I mean, you're actually showing us the page, and
yeah.
You do know the book and
yeah.
The page, and that, in fact, when I see line breaks, and especially when it's up against the beautiful watercolors like that, it becomes then, it's sort of like own line art in itself, as we have on the walls, you know, the word art things, and then your words are up against the art. So you are going to resist any labels on your text?
Well, I don't. It's not really up to me to decide that. I think for when people read it, then they tell me what they think it is. That's kind of where most labeling comes from.
I felt there was a certain certain parallel between your works in the sense that that Casey's search is more interior, and Peter's is more in the landscape, the outer landscape versus the inner landscape, but that. There's a lot of desire, you know, in that's parallel there, and a kind of empathic quest.
Well, we're both dealing with what it feels like to live in a place in deep transition, a place that's disappearing from us as we live in it every day, and we can't lie about it.
You know, if you're only 30 years old, what is it that you've seen in your life?
That's right.
Okay, so you're out here, meta, and Casey is down here.
But what's so interesting is what Casey brings to the discussion. I mean, it's amazing what his generation experiences.
Right.
I mean, they may not experience Harry's Delicatessen or something that my generation is associating with a certain Gloucester, but we're all, I mean, and I think in some ways we're both, I mean, because Casey writes, you write Noah is an interesting character, really. I mean, there's a lot about Noah in this in your narrative. I mean, he's not just let us say a stand-in for you. He's beyond. He's more than a stand-in for you. But it's a person struggling to find meaning in relationships, in work, in the place. There are scenes in Casey's book. And even longer scenes in earlier manuscripts of Gloucester at night that are so extraordinary. I mean, I would read them over and over and over again. What it is like to walk down the street in the middle of the night in Gloucester. What do you see? What do you feel? The images or even the night life. What people are doing at night.
Peter?
Yes.
I think I agree with you. For me, that's for me the strongest, most vivid part of your book, Casey. And I would point out a different set of your work, really, where there's a kind of beauty and simmering violence in the city, right? Mm. And that's something that you don't have to be. You know, you could be 14 and get that right now in the city. Or you could have been 14, like when you write about it in your memoir, right?
And, yes.
You know, that kind of like simultaneous beauty, and then the particularly like the nocturnal beauty, the dark side, right, which is literal right now. If we went just like kind of across the street, right, and looked over the harbor and the mix of kind of, you know, oil slicks still in the water, but also the lights on the water and all that. Just, there's a combination of the kind of industrial, but also like the violence in our hearts you know, from frustrated desire, Martin, you mentioned, right?
Yeah.
The desire that you mentioned, right, is a frustrated desire in both of your work. And I think that's the thing that, you know, transcends it being just, you know, we find it here in Gloucester, but that's why these stories are bigger than Gloucester, to, you know, get outside Gloucester, right? They're not just for us, for reading, because of that. And that's just stuff that I've seen in both of your...
Well, you know, there's a deep sense of mourning going on in this community that is not being acknowledged. And I think the writers are getting at it. There are as many, many writers in this town getting at it, one way or another, through poetry, through fiction, through memoir. And it's almost like it's being looked at, because there are people who will talk about it. Look at the popularity of, you know, it's Gloucester when these Facebook pages, and behind all of this is a sense of what's been lost, not just in a sense of what I want to say is nostalgia. That's not what it's about, because nostalgia is not really the deep mourning that we're trying to talk about, I'm trying to write about it. And in some ways, Casey's dealing with it too in his book. This is a community that is struggling with that, and I think it's the responsibility of writers to help people articulate that. It really is important, because as a way that the community can grow, the way that the community can continue to be that this extraordinary place that we've all lived in. And we're living in.
Hey, Peter.
Yes.
Question?
Yes.
Dave in the back. So in Broken Trip,
you
really talked about what had happened in the 1980s, the early 1980s that I had grown up in.
Yeah.
And Casey came of age in the 90s, and much of what had happened in the 80s continued on into the 90s. The heroin addiction, the drug importation to Gloucester through the fishing boats, the burglaries, the constant crime, constant fear of house breaks and violence. So you get to that in Broken Trip. So what I'm really curious about is, in your morphology of how Gloucester has changed, is it that Gloucester rebounded from the 1980s, and then that kind of something good was coming back, and then that's been shut down by the development and the hotel and all that? Or is it that devastation stayed, and that people who were ambitious to redevelop the waterfront kind of leapt on that devastation and preyed upon that? I mean, where do you feel that all happened? You do deal with all of it, but in different segments, in different books.
It's not easy, but, you know, a myth was created. A myth was created that fishing was dead, that the community was falling apart, that the people didn't care. And I'm not saying it as clearly as I could, but it's a series of myths that were created that are all interrelated. That paved the way for the kind of development that I don't believe a lot of people really want to live with.
Yeah.
I'm telling you that from what I see and what I hear. Not just people who are activists, but people that you see on the streets. There was no rebounding. I think this is part of a process. The crime, the drugs and all that's, I mean, all of that was part of the degradation of Gloucester,
right?
In many ways. So I don't think that's ever been, I don't think we ever surmounted that.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a narrative then that was created by developers and people who wanted to profit from it, that this was then finite, it's over, we can never really regrow the fishing industry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that myth. It's that it's dead forever.
Yeah. You know, yes. I realize that the connection between this and like blockbusting in the neighborhoods in Boston.
Of course.
It's like the same.
Of course. Gentrification is a piece of it. Go ahead.
A bunch of things. First of all, the mourning, you know, is really deeply embedded in the 300-plus years. And I just want to get a shout-out to the memory of Joe Garland, who who wrote about the fact that when you live proximate to the kind of losses that people experience, losing family members, husbands, sons at sea, you know, you were proximate to a lot of loss. And I think that that thread of you know, the approximation to, you know, that mourning, that ongoing mourning, is something that persists, mm-hmm. and actually is part of what makes this community, I don't want to say unique, but, you know, we have that. If you've lived here long enough, especially if you've lived here all your life, and you come from generations, especially from fishermen, there's a sadness that is just part of how you live. And I think somehow it has a strengthening or a, I'm not sure what to call it. It also unites us and ties us not just to the sea, but to the root system. The other thing I wanted to say is, Casey, maybe it's not poetry, but I think that there's a lyricism in your writing. That's what I get. And so I wouldn't necessarily put a label on it, but I would say that there's a song quality that's very engaging. And then the other thing, Peter, I know that Grace Paley was a mentor of yours and one of my favorite writers. And in terms of dialogue, I think she was absolutely
nobody great. Better.
Got, you know, yeah. Got just engaging,
wonderful
dialogue.
Peter, I feel a sense of mourning when I see Beach Court, my grandfather Fitzgerald's house, where we all played as kids and swam on the beach and had such a good time, and now Matt Bell bought it. We bought the house next to it, and you know, those are going to be gone. And that was such a great place to grow up, you know. So many happy memories there, and that's all gone. Old sense of community.
Well, the loss, you know, of these kinds of places. Remember when Gloucester has been 14 years without a master plan. And when the planning process started, and we had Plan 2000, one of the things that Janice DeLuto, who started that process, God bless her, she asked everybody to come in with descriptions of what they considered to be magical places in their life in Gloucester. Places like you were talking about, Beach Court. She asked everyone to come in, and there were wonderful discussions. And the whole point of the plan was to specify what these places were, try to find ways of saving them, try to understand how they work together in the fabric of the community. It was an incredible process. And the plan that came together was a marvelous plan. Put on the shelf, as most plans in Gloucester are, completely forgotten, never paid attention to, and now we're 14 years, and the community's going ahead. How can a community enter the future without a plan? How can a household live without a plan? If you don't have a budget, if you don't have a plan, where do you know we're going next? And we have no plan in Gloucester for where we're going. That's why, bang, a hotel is here, bang, something's here, bang, something there. That is the whole point. No plan. And force these things on the community, and we're victims. So, but the power comes when you have a plan. You're not victimized. You know where you stand. Zoning comes after planning. Zoning doesn't precede planning. What we've done in Gloucester is zone, rezone, and not plan. You have to plan first, and then you zone or rezone. We don't do that in Gloucester. So, I mean, I don't mean to get into a big political discussion, but these are kinds of things that this is what we're living with. And this, as a writer, I feel it's part of my responsibility as a writer living in this community, you know, to try to grapple with these things in my work, to try to share it with other people. Anyway, thank you for anything else, because I think we're coming down to the end. Anybody else want to say anything? And
I'd just like to say,
yes.
Casey, I'm sorry to hear you weren't writing for so long, and we don't want to hear about that again.
Joanne, you're fabulous.
To say that if you think that you're alone in the difficulty of writing, it's all a march to the computer, all of us. It's not. We're not going there with joys in our hearts.
No.
You just sit there, and especially when you said, well, you're not writing, but you were trying to write. It's not. If you're sitting there, you're writing. You're not trying. Mm-hmm. You are writing. So, you know, you sit, you just do it. You know, you have to show up, and it'll come.
That's well said.
And, mm-hmm. and just do it, you know, a little bit every day. Like meditation, eventually it will come, and it will never get easier, and it will never not be a struggle to go, but just that's the nature of the beast. So that's it. You just keep writing.
That's fabulous advice, Joanne. I mean, that's really fabulous. You that's really coming from where we all need to be. Honestly, that's fabulous. Well, thank you very much, folks. Great job. Great job.